very much for coming to the talk, or staying for the talk. It's 4:30 on Friday afternoon, so that takes commitment. So the work I'm about to tell you is basically the PhD project of Michael Kahn and Birkenbusch, who graduated last November. And some of the more recent stuff has been done by Francois Blanchet, who's a senior postdoc at the James Franck Institute. And Ty Cohen is an experimentalist at Cornell. So in the process of doing this, we've had a lot of help. Some of them are from the experimentalists. Sarah Case and Jason Wyman are students in St. Nagel's lab, and of course SID. And also from a bunch of theorists and simulators. So Todd Dupont, Leo, Tom Witowski, Howard Stone have very helpful discussions. Alfonso Garancavo is someone who works on flow focusing. And while nothing I'm going to tell you has anything explicitly flow focusing or microfluidics, it somehow reminded Alfonso of that, and he kept talking to us. So before we go on, let me just tell you what is it that I want to tell you about. And the easiest way for me to do that is to just introduce you to the experiment. So there are a couple of versions of this experiment, but I'll start with the first version. So what we have here is a box, and it's about this big. It's about 30 centimeters across. And you put into this box two layers of liquid. Make sure they're immiscible. So in this version, the lower layer is a mixture of water and glycerin, and the upper layer is silicon oil. The lower layer is about 12 centimeters deep, the upper layer is about 12 centimeters deep. And the next thing you do is that you stick a glass pipette into the upper layer, and you start sucking stuff out. It's a very simple concept. This is what you see. So the idea is, okay, you have surface tension between the two layers, so they want to keep separate. But you're also creating this flow in the both layers because you're sucking out the tube. And then the game is, I'm going to control the flow rate through the tube, and I'm going to look at the interface and say, what does the interface shape look like? And what you get is basically two regimes. The interface can either be in a state where it's not broken, so you just have this hump that's sitting below the interface, and you have flows in the upper layer going up. Or if you push this total withdrawal flux above a critical value, which I'm going to call QC, something really remarkable happens. You manage to break the surface, and what you get is this fairly thin liquid spout going up into the tube. And this is the regime that we call viscous entrainment, because you're no longer just getting the upper layer liquid into the tube, you're getting both the upper and the lower layer. And notice how nature decides to go through this transition. It decides, when I just start to suck out the liquid from the lower layer, I'm not going to take that much out. I'm only going to take a little bit. So if you ask me how thin can this spout be, the thinnest you can get is about 50 microns. So the workshop title is sort of microfluidics in technology and in nature. So in this experiment, it's completely Mother Nature, and she does pretty well. I mean, it's 50 microns. And so the first obvious thing is, can you make it smaller? Why is it 50 microns? You know, can you do something useful with it?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Am I to understand that the spout is rotating?
Oh, there is this here, just to tell you that it's a 3D problem. It's axisymmetric. It's a real tube.
Oh.
Yeah, it's good.
And the tube is as wide as it looks?
Yeah, it's not Photoshop, and I didn't distort the image. And it's about, you have an idea, it's not very big. These are not big things. It's half a centimeter.
That's huge.
This spout by itself, this is not the thinnest thing we can get, but that's a different story. The next thing I want to tell you is that, of course, there is a very useful thing, we hope, that we're trying to do with this liquid spout. And this is not something I'm working on personally, but it's a joint effort with Sid Nagel, Milan Markic, who's in chemistry, and Mark Garfinkel, who's at the University of Chicago Hospital, and a bunch of postdocs and students, in particular Jason Wyman. So there is something that you immediately notice about the thin spout, is that it's a very good tool. Well, maybe it's the second thing. The first thing is that, you can make wires, so consider it said. The second thing you notice is that, suppose I put particles into the lower fluid. What will happen? Well, once in a while, this particle is going to go below the spout and get sucked up into it. Once it's sucked up into the spout, surface tension is going to cause the liquid spout to break up around this particle, and it's going to coat it evenly. And it's a very beautiful encapsulation technique, because if you have a bigger particle, it's going to break up in the lower region. If you have a smaller particle, it's going to break up a little bit higher. And what it guarantees is a uniform coat of roughly the same thickness, regardless of the particle size and regardless of the particle shape. And this is something that no standard industrial coating technology can do, because what they typically do is that you do things like spin coating. It's a very violent process, and it guarantees you uniform size of final product. So if you have particles of different sizes, you get thick coats for the little ones, and thin coats or no coats at all for the big ones. And then you say, okay, fine, that's good. But what kinds of particles deserve this kind of exquisitely gentle handling? Well, biological cells. So what Mark Garfinkel would like to do is to have the following therapy for type 1 diabetes. So the idea is that if you have diabetes, you have to give yourself insulin injections, and it's kind of painful. So wouldn't it be better if you could take islet cells from a pig, transplant it into your body, have it remain healthy and viable for 5 years, producing insulin in response to glucose levels in your body, and you never have to think about it. Now, of course, your body's immune system will never tolerate this. So you have to have a way to separate these transplanted cells from the from your immune response, or you're going to be taking drugs that knock your immune system off for 5 years, and that's very bad. So what you need is a way to achieve immuno-isolation. So you need to generate a coat which is uniform, which is thin, around these islet cells. And these cells are about 100 to 300 microns in size, and they're very irregular in shape. So let me very quickly just tell you how they do this. What they do is they put polymer monomers into the lower fluid. So you take this islet cell, you put it into the liquid spout, you let the coat break up, and then you cross-link the polymers. So in the process of which you created this meshwork of polymers around the cell. And then what these pictures are showing you is that it actually works. So the important thing is that the green are dye molecules which are of the same size as the smallest of the antibodies. And red are small molecules that are sugar. And what you're supposed to see is that when you have the encapsulated cells, you don't see any green at all. So this coat is able to exclude large molecules. And the next thing I want to show you, I mean, this is sort of an ongoing effort, is that this coating process is really gentle, and we've done nothing to harm the cells. This is a study of insulin concentration that's being produced as a function of time. And there's a population of encapsulated islets, there's a population of encapsulated ones, and you're varying the concentrations of glucose. And what you're supposed to see is just that there are two curves, and they're right on top of each other. So in terms of, you know, can you actually create encapsulated, and does it actually harm the cell? The answer is, you know, this is sort of, it's working. And right now, sort of, one of the things we're trying to do is sort of take islet cells from rats, encapsulate them, and transplant them into mice. I'm not sure how these guys are doing. But so I just want to tell you that there's a very serious sort of biotechnology that they're developing at UChicago. And the starting point of this is this rather beautiful thin liquid spout. So we really kind of want to understand what sets the thickness of the spout and how does it work. Now, I've sort of told you sort of one reason why I'm interested in this process. Now, let me just back up a second to tell you another reason, one that's sort of a little bit closer to my heart. And one of the things that you kind of notice when you look at these spouts is that, you know, this is not the only thing that creates these thin tendrils, right? There are a lot of other processes, important or unimportant, that also leave very thin tendrils behind. So for example, sort of, if you have a drop and it's sliding down a window pane, you know, this is what happens when it rains, but what you see is that when it's large and starts sliding, it's going to leave behind a thin tendril. Another example, this is an experiment that's done by Michael Mangel and Mike Jelinek, is in sort of non-Mosinex thermal convection. And what they see, which they're very excited by, are the fact that if you have these two layers of fluid and thermal convection, the lower layer is going to get entrained by the upper layer. As here, I'm not having anything that sucks the lower layer up, it's just that I have convection cells in the upper layer. And again, you see the creation of these very thin tendrils. And somehow, the interplay between the geometry of the sparse thing, just basically the kinds of flow I'm putting down, and the geometry of the interface, seems to be creating a small length scale. So what exactly is going on? And you know, this is something where a series can get really excited about. So this is what I'm going to focus on. Basically, the way I'm going to do it, I'm going to go back to the experiment, the first one I told you about, and I'm going to focus on the regime where I only have selective withdrawal. And the reason why I'm doing this is very simple, because this is the regime where we actually have experimental data. So just to highlight the degree to which we don't understand this, Italians never really measured anything for the spout regime. And I said, why don't you guys measure anything? And they said, how do we measure it? Because you have this shape which starts to, you know, starts kind of big and starts to taper. If you pick an absolute size from the undisturbed surface and measure the radius, are you sure you're measuring the same thing all the time? So it's just, without some ideas, it's even hard to experimentally quantify what's going on. So what he decided to do is to measure two things. One is you stay in the selective withdrawal regime, you measure the height of this hump, which is, and you ask, what's the maximum height of this hump? And you measure how curved this hump gets, and you characterize that by a curvature kappa and ask, what is the maximum value of this? So that's one of the things that you want to know. The other thing which is very useful to know is what sets QC, what sets the onset of entrainment where you can't get this state anymore and start to get these in spouts? And finally, the third question, which is sort of a more fundamental question, is that what we really have here is a topology change on the free surface. You're imposing a flow and it's driving a changing topology. So what is the fundamental mechanism behind this topology change? How general is it? How robust is it? How often should I expect to see this? Okay? So before I go on further, let me just tell you something about the detail of the experiment. So first thing is that there's something, of course, very special about the selective withdrawal regime, which is that, okay, you're sitting here, here's the interface, there's a hump here. What it does is that you have an upper layer, which is an entraining flow that's moving inward, a lower layer, which is recirculating. So right at the tip of this pump, there's a stagnation point. I mean, if it's a steady surface, it has to be there, right? I mean, it's just nothing else you could do, which means that if you want to characterize what the flow is doing to the interface, then you can't really talk about a velocity scale. You have to talk about a strain rate. Does that make sense? Because the flow right at the tip is, if the tip is steady state, zero. And so if you go through and try to calculate strain rate, it's about 0.3 inverse seconds. So immediately the thing that I'm telling you is that, just as I said, you know, the flow doesn't seem to be imposing the length scale. All you have is this inverse time scale. And then something is giving you the 50 microns. What is it? Well, the only other two things which are giving you length scales are the height of the pipette and this thing called the capillary length scale, which is basically where surface tension effects balance with gravity. And the important thing about these two length scales, other than they're completely different from each other in origin, is that they're both quite large. They're both about half a centimeter. So by themselves, they don't obviously give you 50 microns. okay. And the other thing is that, of course, I can convert these things into dimensionless numbers. So the Reynolds number is very tiny. The Kaplan number, which basically measures how large the flow effects are relative to surface tension, is also very small, which tells you that surface tension is important. The Bond number, well, it's a 10, so gravity is kind of important. And finally, there's something which I'm calling lambda, which is just a viscosity ratio. And I'm going to only think about the case where they're about comparable with each other. So here are all the parameters. And the next thing is, okay, so the experiment, I've already told you they made measurements. What do the measurements say? And this is the situation where the story gets really a little bit wild. So if you measure the curvature as a function of the flow rate, you know, here's a typical set. You start and the interface is almost flat, so the curvature is small. And then you increase the flow rate and the curvature gets larger and larger and larger. It really seems, looks like it's about to take off and go through the roof, right? So you can go through and do this thing, which is kind of natural. If you start to see one quantity that becomes very large, then you say, okay, is it really going through the roof? If it's diverging, I should be able to find some kind of power law. So this is what Itai did. He plotted the curvature as a function of delta Q over Q. And you know, this is three decades quite a nice, beautiful power law. So it looks like as you're approaching the transition, the curvature is trying to become infinitely large. It has some kind of a scaling exponent. It's not a nice fraction of integers. Yeah?
Can I ask a question? I didn't understand. You have these different data sets that are peeling off and the curvature is growing.
Yeah.
What's different about them?
The height of the pipette. Thanks for that. It's not different days or anything like that. And the important thing is that all these different sets can get rescaled onto. You can collapse them. So this looks very good. And we kind of have this problem. So we seem to have a scaling exponent. We have no understanding of why it should be this scaling exponent. The other problem is that in the experiment, we really cannot get the curvatures to be larger than 1 over 50 microns. If it's really divergent, as the data suggests, why am I not getting something smaller? So you're kind of in the situation where on one hand, you say, OK, all the measurements I have seems to indicate that this is how the topology change happens. I have a home which is nice and gentle and broad. I increase the forcing, and it gets sharper and sharper and sharper and sharper until at a definite value of the forcing, it becomes infinitely sharp. So now, if you want to increase the forcing even more, the only thing for the interface to do is open up. So that's the story that's being indicated by the inset here, which says that kappa is diverging. The surface at transition is trying to become singular. But if that were really true, you should be able to find the surface as singular as possible. And in the experiment, they weren't able to find anything that's sharper than 50 microns. So somehow the data are not agreeing. And of course, the other thing about this, if you're a theorist, is that weird scaling exponents gets you very excited because it's supposed to be weakly first order first phase transitions or self-similar solutions of the second kind, that means that there are great things to do. So lots of people got very excited trying to think about it. And what I'm going to say at the end of the day is it's not that. It's something else kind of weird going on, but it's not that. Okay. So what kinds of work have existed about this class of problems? And basically, not very much, and they sort of fall into two classes. One are sort of works which are exactly like the system I told you about, equal viscosity withdrawal. And they're mostly done by people who are interested in geophysical flows. So there's a particularly nice work that's done by John Lister. And unfortunately, he looked at only the regime of very strong stratification, so I told you that here, in our case, stratification is kind of weak. So it's not quite in the same regime as this experiment. The other problem is that he didn't really look at the interface dynamics. He was just interested in the value of QC. The second class of experiments are sort of the viscous version, what happens when you unplug your bathtub. So you have a whole tank of viscous fluid, air above, and you put a hole in the bottom, and then you unplug the hole. And then you watch the whole thing drain out. And what you'll see is that as the surface drains, a very, very sharp cusp is going to start to form. And then you look at this and this must be telling me something about your experiment. And there's a problem with this. And the problem is that typically, this is very viscous, and the level of the interface is slowly changing because it's draining. So I never know, when I look at these experiments, whether I really have steady state or not. So it's a bit hard to compare the two. So all this just to tell you that you really need to do something. There is no answer out there. Okay, so somehow we want to model the process. And here, I'm going to take an approach which is very different from the last talk, John's. Which basically tries to go through and solve the right equations, solve the right situation, include everything. I don't want to do the entire experiment. I, in fact, want to do as little of the entire experiment as possible. So let me tell you the reason why. So as I understand it, the whole story is confusing, is that I should be getting something which goes to infinity, but it seems to be cut off at a large value. So you start to think, oh, there are all sorts of small effects which could give you this cutoff. One way to check this idea is to retain only sort of the order one effects and say, by themselves, do I see anything interesting? If I don't see anything interesting, then it must be one of the small effects. Because it's not so obvious that by themselves, they can't give you a small effect. So what are the essential things? So we looked at this and we thought about it. And finally, Marco basically said, there are only two things about this problem you really need to keep. First of all, there's a very deep reservoir of the lower liquid. And second, you have two imposed link scales. And third, is that the Reynolds number is very small. So you have viscous flows in both fluids. And what that means is that you can rewrite the evolution of the interface in terms of a boundary integral. And basically what it does is that you can write the velocity on the interface as a surface integral over a suitably defined closed surface. The other way to say this is that the equations are essentially linear, so you have a Green's function. So once you say that, basically the game is, can you define a closed surface, which would do roughly what you want to do? And you want to define it in such a way that it's as inexpensive as possible. And this is what we came up with. So we said, okay, first, we don't want to put in the entire pipette with the entire shape of the pipette. We're going to just drive the flow with a point sink, which is placed at a distance, some distance S above the interface. The other thing we want to say is that we don't want to actually simulate what's going on over the entire interface, because over most of the interface is just flat and seems very boring. So what we're going to do is following. We're going to calculate the surface, including effective surface tension in this region, and everything outside of that, we're going to pretend that the interface is completely flat. And it's doing absolutely nothing. So basically what it amounts to is that I'm treating the hydrostatic pressure group, or gravity, as a pinning condition. It's just a hard cutoff link scale. Beyond some link scale A, the interface is flat. And then, of course, I told you I have to close the interface. So the way we close it is to basically define the interior surface and demand that across this interior surface, the stress has to be continuous. Okay, so this is a very bare bones basic model. And by this point, you should be a little bit worried because it's so basic, it doesn't really look like the experiment anymore. This is the only equation in the plot, just to show you that that's what you actually have to solve. Okay, are there questions, comments? Okay, so let me just go through and show you that this model actually does a very good job of describing what's going on in the experiment. So first, what you can do is that you can just go through using this model and calculate the steady state interfaces at a given withdrawal flux Q. So what I'm showing you here is just a sequence of these surfaces. So this is at low total flow rate, and now I'm slowly increasing Q, and you can see that because I require the interface to be completely flat, it's always going to zero at these edges. And then as I increase the forcings further and further, I'm going to get to this red curve, which is the critical surface. And then if I increase forcing even further, I'm not going to get any steady state solution anymore. The only solutions I can find are solutions which basically run away towards the sink and never come back. So the last shape you're seeing is not a steady state shape, but a runaway solution at a point in time. And the other thing I'm putting, just to remind myself to tell you this, is of course we try to be careful and have a mesh which is adaptive so that we resolve the curve regions with enough points in them. So if I look at these surfaces, they look roughly like the experiments. With something like this, you know, I basically only gave myself two things to play with, the height of the sink and this link scale A, which is sort of the link scale where the interface fastens up. So what you can ask is, what exactly is setting the interface link scale? And in this case, there are basically two limiting regimes in the model. One is where I have the sink really, really close to the undisturbed interface. And what that basically says is that it doesn't really care you're pinning it at a very large distance, because the flow link scale is on the order of the sink height. If the flow is going to decay to zero on order S, and S is a lot smaller than A, then you don't really care about A. The other limit is if you have the sink very far away, and A is very small, and this is the regime where the model situation starts to become very different from the experiment, because what you really have is something that's almost like an interface that's pinned at a capillary and is being pulled out by a uniform flow. So just so that you know. So here are the results. So what I'm plotting here is the curvature at the transition, the height of the hump at transition, as a function of these two, of the ratio of the two link scales, the height of the sink and the radius A, or you know, the surface, the pinning distance A. And if you look at these two curves, you know, one thing becomes very straightforward is that the two-link scales are basically doing the same kind of thing. The curvature is an inverse length scale. So in one limit, as I make S smaller and smaller, H is starting to decrease linearly, and the curvature is increasing linearly as well. In the other limit, as I make S over A larger and larger, the maximum pump height is saturating, and the maximum curvature looks like it's about to saturate as well.
Is there any hint of scaling as you make S over A large at the critical curvature as a function of S over A? I mean, is there any hint of some power law?
Oh, yeah. Before it turns in this region?
No, other region. Well, in the intermediate region.
Oh, in this region. I mean, it's just changing over from one to the other. I'm not sure I'm asking.
Well, here it looks on log paper like a straight line then with a crossover. So the hint of scaling that you have in the experiment, I'm wondering if that's mimicked in any way by...
let me just tell you what happens with the experiment. So, in the experiment, remember, I'm showing you kappa versus delta Q. Yeah. This is kappa max as I change the forcing length scale.
Sorry.
So it's going to take a couple graphs before that one comes back again. All I'm showing you this is just that I have these two link scales in the model, and I play with them, and I realize they have exactly the same dependencies on the imposed link scale. They really track each other. And this is I need to tell you this, because I need to explain how I'm going to compare results from this model, which is very drastically simple, to the actual experiment. So this is the idea. The two link scales I have basically track each other. So that means that if I have shapes at the interface, I can rescale them by the maximum hump height, hc. And once I rescale them this way, it should remove most of the dependencies on the geometry of the withdrawal flow and on any of the imposed link scales. So if I want to compare the experiment with the simulation, what I should say is that this link scale A is my capillary link scale, and I'm going to rescale all the link scales I have, the real dimensional link scales in the experiment, by the maximum pump height. Okay, so this is a graph that Lincoln was asking about. So here's a comparison of a calculation from the model against the experiment. So I'm showing you five sets of data. They're taken at different heights of the pipette. So this is the plot of curvature. It's being rescaled by the maximum pump height and delta Q divided by QC. So there are a couple things to notice. First is that the red solid curve is a simulation. Everything with symbols is the experiment. The second thing to notice is that they actually agree with each other very well. I mean, I told you that I should be able to scale out the fact that the flows are different and the geometries are different just by using the correct rescaling link scale, and I'm able to do that. The third thing, the most striking thing to notice, is that the curvature is saturating. Both in the experiment and in the simulation. You're not able to see this very well in the experiment because the curvature takes a very long time to saturate. You have to get within 10 to the minus 3 of the transition before you start to see this curve really turning over. But when you compare the sets of data, you can really see. So I just want to emphasize, the data you see in this graph is exactly the same data that you're seeing here. They didn't redo the experiment, they didn't measure anything different. And so you say, what happened? Well, I mean, this is one of those things, right? You can, if you have, this is why you sort of try to dive for dynamic range. If you have a range of data here, and the data doesn't really cover the full saturation, then if you just change the value of QC slightly, you can straighten out this curve. And then what is actually saturating is going to look like a power law. If you guys haven't done this, I really recommend you doing this. It just teaches you how to think about everybody else's power law scheme differently. And then the other thing, sort of the last thing which is important, is that because we have this good agreement between the model and the experiment, there's sort of this very important fact that you've certainly noticed, is that when you actually rescale with the relevant length scale, what you realize is that, you know, the shape is really not that singular, because the shortest length scale I have, which is 1 over kappa c, and the largest length scale I have, which is hc, is only different by a factor of 7. Yes?
On the left-hand side, the denominator is qc, right?
On the left-hand side? Oh, you mean this plot?
That should be qc, right?
No, it's actually q. And there's a very long story I can tell you about what happens if you believe transition is weakly first order and you're trying to deduce the scaling. But I don't want to do it now. I can tell you later.
Like, okay, simple question. I mean,
no, it's not a simple question. let me say it this way. If you think something is approaching a singular shape, but then being cut off at a small length scale by some other physical effect, and all you're interested is the approach to the singularity, then what you want to do is that you want to pick out the scaling in the range when you're not particularly close to QC. And this is, dividing by Q is sort of an established traditional way of deducing what the scaling behavior is without getting screwed up because you have saturation. And it's not, I mean, it's something which will take me half an hour or even longer to go to. So I don't want to, it is done this way. And that's another reason why it can look so deceptively straight in the other plot. Okay, so let me just summarize. I started by telling you that this experiment has all this weird behavior, and then I told you about a very simple model. And what I have shown you is that the model can explain certain things about the experiment. It can tell you what the curvature is doing. Now, the next thing is, can the model tell you when is it that you start to get entrainment? What sets the entrainment threshold? And, you know, so here, I'm doing something which is a little more dangerous, because QC, ideally, should care a lot about the geometry of the withdrawal flow you're putting down. And remember, in the model, I'm driving everything with a point sink. In the experiment, they're sucking things through a tube. So the geometry is not that alike. But this is the point where we're very encouraged by the fact that we're getting good agreement, so we figured, you know, we have it, let's just try it. Okay. Let's see how I'm doing this time. I'm going to say this quickly, and if you really want to know how the logic goes, please ask me afterwards. The first thing you can do is to just say, what should the scaling behavior for the entrainment threshold be, given the observed dependencies of length scales on S? And what you end up convincing yourself is that within the model system, basically QC should always scale like S squared. So if you increase the Hilbert sink by a factor of 4, by a factor of 2, then QC should change by a factor of 4. On the other hand, I also told you that when you get to the limit where S is much larger than A, the model stops being a very good approximation of the situation in the experiment. So you can go to and try to do a little bit better, and when you try to do a little bit better, and this is something that already was mentioned by John Lister a while back, what you see is that QC should scale like S cubed. So the first thing we did, just to make sure we're not nuts, is to just compute what the onset of entrainment is and plot it against S over A, and compared against results from John Lister. And what you should see is that basically where you can start to, so I told you that the model stops being a very good approximation of entrainment from a flat layer when S over A is large. So you should not believe anything it says way out here. But to the degree I can compare, I'm getting roughly numbers correct. Now what does it do with the experiment? And this is where it's kind of funny. So two simulations that agree at least numerically with each other. And if you just take those two and think about the trends, what you would say is, well, when S over A is small, I expect my model to work well, so it's okay. And then when it gets to be order one, it should change over to this simulation and start to increase much more rapidly with S. Here are all the different experimental results of QC versus S. And what you see is that all of them lie below both of these calculations. And then the next thing we said is that, you know, we really weren't expecting to land, to predict everything correctly. So what if I just allow myself to reduce QC, so I'm just going to shift this curve down. I'm not changing anything else. Yeah?
How did you, sorry, I missed. How do you define A in the experiment?
Oh, A is the capillary length scale.
Oh, the capillary length.
Yeah, so the idea is that in the model, I just say, once I get past the point A, the interface should be flat. Physically, in the experiment, once you're on the capillary length scale, gravity takes over, and the interface starts flattening down. Now, in the model, it's a very abrupt. Once you're there, you're flat. In real life, it's a gentle decay. So, you know, that's why I'm saying with all these things, you don't expect to get the numerical prefactor right. So now I'm just going to shift the curve down and say, am I getting anything right? Like, am I getting the dependencies right? And what you can see is that there's a certain amount of scatter between the data sets, but it's basically doing a fairly good job. So I'm looking at a plot like this, and I say, well, how QC is scaling with the imposed length scales is actually well captured. But the differences between the geometry of the imposed flow, between using a sink and using a tube, is going to change the numerical prefactor, and I'm not getting that right. Okay. So this sort of wraps up two parts of the talk. And the last question I'm going to talk about is, what exactly is the transition mechanism? So the first thing you can do is that you can just look at how the two length scales, the height and the curvature, saturate as Q is approaching QC. I mean, this is the nice thing about the numerical model, is that you have as much dynamic range as you're willing to pay for. And in this case, it's actually really useful, because when you plot how they saturate, what you realize is that they both saturate as a square root of delta Q. At this point, we were very happy, because of course we understand square root of delta Q. This is the classic signature of a saddle node bifurcation. So the story there is that basically, if you see a stable hump, there also exists an unstable hump solution. And as you increase the forcing, the stable and unstable solutions approach each other, and at QC, they coincide. So when you're above QC, you don't have any hump solutions at all, and that's why you start to get onset of injury. The important thing about this is that it says, really, fundamentally, this shape transition is discontinuous. But the thing it doesn't really sort out is this issue that's raised by the experimental data, which is that, is anything about the shape evolution involving the approach to singularity? And let me just try to explain why is it doesn't. Sort of, if you look at delta H versus delta Q, I mean, this is showing you the full range of simulation plus the experimental data. And it's very funny, right? You don't see any transients. The whole thing is a square root. So, I mean, that's that. But if you see how does the curvature saturate, what you notice is that, you know, again, it's taking three decades before you start to see definite signs of a square root behavior. So when you compare these two graphs, what you're certainly asking yourself is that in the first three decades, is there a different kind of dynamics going on? Because what you're seeing, and this is all you're seeing in the experiment, is that the height is saturating, but the curvature is still increasing dramatically. I mean, this is why when you do the experiment, you can fool yourself into thinking, oh, I'm starting to approach a singular shape. Because one of the length scales is saturating, and the other one is still going through the roof. So is it possible that sort of something about the dynamics here, if you were able to formulate it in terms of an ideal problem, would have as its solution something which has a singular shape? I mean, this is the part which gets kind of mathematical. It's an issue if I get out of the real situation and remove certain effects which are in the real situation, does there exist in the nearby phase space a solution which is singular? And then you say, well, there's no way you can figure this out. You just have a numerical model. This is something you have to do using analytics. And I'm not sure I don't agree with you, but let me tell you what we did. So the first thing we did is that we said, OK, let's go to a problem where we're sure there is a singular shape. And what we did was to look at the 2D version of this problem. I can tell you exactly what it involves, but I think I won't. I just, as I say, it's the 2D, it's a 2D version of this problem. And what I'm doing here is plotting log of the curvature, again, rescaled by the maximum hump height, divided by the hump height over the maximum pump height. And I just want to sort of point out this is a weird plot because it's linear on the x-axis and logarithmic on the y-axis. So what it's trying to tell you is how does the curvature and the pump height evolve together as you increase QC, as you increase total flow rate. So in this regime, the flow rate is weak, so both the curvature and the pump height is small. And as we go towards one, we're going closer and closer to the entrainment transition. And in this 2D problem, the curvature really has approaches the singularity, and it's diverging. And this is something that has an analytic solution, and we just basically took the analytic solution and plotted the surface shape. And then all we're doing is that, okay, suppose we made a mistake, and HC in the experiment is not quite the real HC, but where the dashed blue line is. Then what we'll see is a curve like this. We wouldn't really see the fact that kappa is getting very large. All we would see is a curve which sort of has this large increase in kappa relative to a gentle increase in h, right? So this is just sort of an education of, okay, if it really had a singularity, but we couldn't get close enough to it, that's what it would look like. Now that we know what something like that would look like, let's go back to the results from the model and say, what does an analogous, what does it look like? So here, I'm plotting kappa versus h from the simulation. And first thing I want you to notice is that it looks very much like the plot I just showed you, right? There's this shoulder region, and then there's this region where you start to see a much more pronounced increase in kappa versus a small increase in h. But the other thing I want you to notice is that this is really a very straight line. I mean, there is no evidence of a curvature anywhere as you look at the upper portion. I mean, this is just going too straight. If it were approaching a singularity, what you are expecting is that there would be some kind of curvature in this, and then it's going to tilt up and really go through the roof. So when we look at this, and then the other thing we said is that, okay, we know at what about value of kappa, we have this switching behavior. Let me just go back a second and remind you. Well, this doesn't take too long. Then we go to this plot. If I plot delta kappa over delta q, what you say is that the first 3 decades, nothing much is happening, and then you start to see this clear evidence of something saturating. So what I could say is that what you would expect is somehow there should be a signature in the dynamics that's associated with this saturation. So do we see anything there? And we don't. So the way to say this is that if I were in a situation where initially I'm trying to evolve towards a shape which is singular, and then later another effect came in and took me away from it, what I would expect is that at the onset of the saturation, the curve should do something different. And what I'm seeing in the numerics is that the curve does nothing different. So what it's saying is that all I'm having is a discontinuous transition. I don't have a singularity in this problem. The next thing you can do is just compare the calculated shape against experimental shape. And this is, again, sort of a plot that has no adjustable parameters. It's just values of curvature, values of height, rescaled by the maximum height. There's some scatter in the data, and we don't really understand why there should be this much scatter in the data, but that's something that I think you just have to redo the experiment to find out. But the other thing, which is really funny, is that if you look at the experiment, you can see that they're all a little bit more curved than the simulation. Let me just pause a second, see if you can all see that. So remember, I just told you this whole story, basically involving deciding what the dynamics is trying to do. And I told you that if this line shows sort of some kind of curvature, maybe I am trying to approach a singularity. And if it's completely straight, then I'm not. And somehow there's a difference between these two sets. So what exactly is different? And we spent a long time trying to figure this out. So what we ended up doing is that we actually, after saying, oh, we don't want to do the whole experiment, we actually run simulations which basically did the whole experiment, with the container, with gravity. We changed the flow geometries. We did the systematic. Nothing really made the simulation curves different from this. So what we always see is that it's shoulder and then a line that just really gets straighter and straighter and straighter, corresponding to basically a logarithmic coupling between the curvature and the height. And then finally we said, you know what? The two layers right now have the same viscosity. But in the experiment, the two layers actually have slightly different viscosities. Because it's just very hard to make it exactly equal. What if we change the viscosity? So this is a plot of what happens when we change the viscosity. All I want you to see is that as you change the viscosity, and so this corresponds to reducing the viscosity of the lower layer, you're starting to get a curve which is showing this uptick as you approach HC. So what I would expect is that if I keep reducing the viscosity of the lower layer and make it smaller and smaller and smaller, in the limit that the lower layer viscosity is actually zero, that's when I actually have a singularity. But any time that I'm at working with a lower layer which has a finite viscosity, I don't have, the interface is not approaching singular shape. Okay, so let me just wrap up. I started out with sort of these three questions. So what I want to tell you is that we've done this model. It's a very simple model and it enables to show that transition is a discontinuous domino. It's not a singularity. And the reason why you could get fooled is that you have this very weak logarithmic coupling between the two length scales in the problem. And this is something which is very robust. Because even when I change the viscosity, over most of the ranges, you're seeing this coupling. When you change the flow of geometry, you're still seeing this coupling. So it's something to really sort of look out for, because you're always going to get into this regime where one of the length scales saturates a lot sooner than the other. And the other thing, which is sort of important for people who make use of this geometry, is that we understand how interface shapes depend on the imposed length scales, and also what sets the onset of QC. Let me just tell you how you get 50 microns. Because remember, I started out by telling you, okay, there's this mysterious 50 micron, and the only way people can talk about this is to say, well, the interface is trying to develop a very sharp cusp. So let me tell you, this is how you would actually get it without going to a singularity at all. So the curvature at the hump, I'm going to call it RC, is, the radius of curvature at the hump, RC is 1 over kappa C. And, you know, remember I showed you that the curvature and the hump height basically have the same dependencies, which means that kappa C HC is always a dimensionless number. So what is this dimensionless number? Well, it happens to be 7. So right immediately it tells you the radius of curvature is always a factor 7 smaller than the hump height. Okay? So now you say, okay, how does the maximum hump height depend on an imposed length scale? Well, in most of the experiments, I'm in the regime where the height of the pipette is very small, small compared to the capillary length scale. So HC depends on the height of the sink. And typically, HC is always about a quarter of the height of the sink. So again, you have a factor of 4. And most of these numbers are depends on the transition dynamics. And the next thing that I'm going to say is that in the simulation, I'm using a sink. In the experiment, they're withdrawing through a tube. The height of the sink and the height of the tube are not quite the same length scales, because when you're at the sink, the velocity is infinite. When you're at the tube, the velocity is finite. So you should allow me some adjustable things. And basically, what I would need to adjust is to say that the height of the pipette is about a factor of 3 of the height of the sink, and then immediately I get a factor of 100. And so basically this factor of 3 just comes from the flow geometry, whether you're using a sink versus whether you're using a tube. So just because the way these small factors multiply, you get a very impressive decrease. the other thing which would be very interesting to do is to actually look at the regime where you're getting a spout. But for this, I just want to point out that really, a lot of the things that we really want to know about the spout, like what makes it as thin as it is already being addressed by the stuff on selective withdrawal. Because if you look at the velocity field associated with the spout, what you have is sort of a withdrawal flow in the upper fluid, a recirculating flow in the lower fluid, and then a very thin layer of flow which is being drawn up into the spout. So what I'm telling you is that the flow topology is basically the same as the flow topology in the selective withdrawal regime. And since it's the topology of the flow which determines the topology of the interface, if you know what the